Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the crisis in California, where the governor faces a budget shortfall twice as big as projected due to declining tax revenues. Mark Paul, a former deputy treasurer of the state of California and author of California Crackup, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How to Fix It, joins us to discuss why the legislature can't raise taxes and further deep cuts are being made at the expense of the poor. Then we'll examine the disconnect between the American public, a majority of whom want to cut military spending, and the Republican Congress, who refuse to cut it even though they've signed off on automatic cuts. Stephen Culler, political psychologist and the director of the Program for Public Consultation and a senior researcher at the Center for International Security Studies, joins us. He has done a survey that finds 3/4 of the respondents favor cutting defense as a way to reduce the deficit, including 2/3 of Republicans as well as 9 out of 10 Democrats. Then finally, we will speak with Roger Lowenstein, the author of The End of Wall Street. He is a veteran financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and now writes for The New York Times and Smart Money. We'll discuss the latest excess on Wall Street and how the Dodd-Frank reforms meant to rein in derivative trading have been watered down since the crash of 2008. And joining us now is Mark Paul, who is the author with Joe Matthews of the book California Crackup, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. He was formerly national editor and editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune and deputy editorial page editor and columnist at the Sacramento Bee. In 2004, Mark Paul was appointed deputy treasurer of the state of California. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Paul.
It's good to be here, Ian.
And I imagine you wouldn't want to be deputy treasurer of the state of California today.
No, I don't think anybody wants to cope with California's fiscal situation from inside of government. We have had a decade of fiscal crisis in California with no end in prospect.
So this, of course, all comes down on Jerry Brown and the idea that they've made 100 billion cuts within the past 4 years. They've curbed spending and boosted taxes temporarily to bridge this deficit of more than $100 billion, and then his projections of what the deficit would be were about 50% under. That's got to be a big shock.
Well, it's not entirely a shock. I think most people who closely follow the budget, understood that the budget passed last June. In Sacramento, had a very aggressive forecast for how much revenue might come in. There was a sense that we had cut so deeply. I mean, schools, in California, we've laid off 11% of the teacher force in the last 3 years. There was a sense that we were, people didn't want to make much deeper cuts and hoped that the money would come in. And of course, unfortunately, it hasn't come in as aggressively as they forecast last June. So we're faced with the same dilemma that they faced last year, which was, whether we we cut and how much we raise revenues.
So we're talking about $4 billion in terms of wishful thinking.
Roughly. And some of it was, there were just some things that also that popped up. Some parts of the budget were blocked in the courts, which added to the current problem. In California, basically has a budget gap, a structural budget deficit of roughly 10% of the budget, 8 to 10% of the budget. We've had that for most of the last decade. Goes up in bad years, but we still haven't figured out how to close that.
So, Mark Paul, again, former deputy treasurer of the state of California and the author with Joe Matthews of California Crackup, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. How different is what we're talking about here in the state of California than what's happening in Europe in terms of the notion of austerity and its relationships to revenue? It seems that the minute you start imposing austerity measures, your revenues dry up. And isn't that what's happening here in the state of California? Or is this all still the continuing fallout from the 2008 Wall Street crash?
It's a combination of things. Certainly, you know, that we have in California in cutting the budget over the last 3 years after the recession. You know, when you lay off teachers and cops and firefighters and other people, you slow the demand for goods and services in the private economy as well. So some of the slowness that we're seeing in the economy, both here and around the nation, is the result of austerity policies, both federal and state. Part of it, though, that California has unique factors that have to do with the two-thirds vote requirement for raising revenues, the initiative process, which is, you know, has readily been used by voters to increase spending for various things without providing any of the revenue to pay for them. California has, you know, parts of its budget problem are unique to its own system, and part of it is just the result. We've had this problem, Ian, for 10 years. I mean, it coming out of the crash of the dot-com boom at the beginning of the 21st century opened a big budget hole in California. And we realized that we'd enacted all the tax cuts in the late 1990s, all of a sudden found ourselves with the dot-com boom having gone away with this structural budget deficit. And we've basically spent the last decade, kicking the can down the road is the technical term in Sacramento, patching over the problem every year and hoping that something will come to our rescue.
So tell me, though, when you look at these cuts that the governor is now proposing and the Democrats are unhappy about it and the Republicans who have basically been in this luxurious position of being able to say no and effectively veto everything. I mean, it's a pretty surreal political system in California where the minority party gets to basically tell the majority party what they can do because of these supermajority requirements. It flies in the face of the logic of democracy. That's California's problem, isn't it?
Well, that's certainly a big piece of it. That we in California have a tax ratchet that turns only one way. A majority of legislators can cut taxes in California, and they have frequently over the last 15 years. But it takes a two-thirds majority of legislators to replace that revenue when we need it. And of course, the legislature has been unable to get a two-thirds majority to permanently up the tax base. We had some temporary tax increases in 2009, but those expired last year.
So in terms of what the governor's proposing, where he's cutting $880 million from CalWORKS, which again serves low-income families and children, $1.2 billion from Medi-Cal, again, that serves the poor, $453 million from child care subsidies, et cetera, et cetera. There's no question that balancing the budget is going to be on the backs of the poor. And it then leads you to the same, and of course the same argument's happening at the federal level. The Republicans are refusing, for example, to cut a dime out of defense spending while wanting to cut back on food stamps, et cetera. So at the federal level, at least in terms of the Republicans in the House, they don't believe in sharing the pain. They want it all on the backs of the poor. Is there anywhere else in the California budget that would be analogous, Mark Paul, to the defense budget? In other words, is there some other low-hanging fruit that's not going to hurt the poor?
Well, it's generally not. I mean, the one part of the budget that had grown rapidly, you know, over the last 15 years was prisons. But last year, the budget, Jerry Brown and the budget, began to reverse that. We are now reducing the number of people in state prison as part of his realignment program last year, and so the share of the state budget that goes to prisons is also now declining for the first time in a couple of decades. So it's just the reality is that California state government, you know, is now as a in relationship to the size of the economy is the smallest it's been since 1972, since Ronald Reagan was governor. And yet, even after all those cuts, it's still, there's not sufficient revenue to fund that level of government, which is why the governor is seeking in the November ballot the temporary tax increases.
So the only then, to answer my question, the only low-hanging fruit to compare to the federal budget, with defense being sacrosanct and going after Medicare and food stamps, etc., the only other kind of, you're talking about instead of the military-industrial complex being sacrosanct, the prison-industrial complex has been sacrosanct, but no longer. And there's, I guess, is there any way to cut it further to make these cuts fair and balanced?
There's probably, in the short run, you know, it is probably very difficult to cut back much more on prisons at a faster rate than Brown has proposed. It would require, you know, we need to, you know, if we rethought in California how we do criminal justice from the, you know, from the street, from the cops on the street up to the prisons and the courts, I'm sure that we could find, you know, ways of doing it smarter than we do. I mean, it is, public safety is the second largest thing that government does in California, after education. But the reality is that the two biggest, overwhelmingly, the two biggest pieces of the budget are education and health care. We have cut in both areas, and it's very difficult to see any way of balancing the budget that doesn't involve further cuts in those areas, unless we go back and restore the level of taxes that we had previous to all the tax cuts.
Well, my understanding is you mentioned the courts. Haven't they taken some fairly substantial cuts in the courts that, you know, if you have to pay a traffic ticket, you have to wait in line all day nowadays, you know?
Everything is in California in the last 3 years has taken major cuts. So it's we have diminished the level of public services, and you know, we're seeing the consequences. The Public Policy Institute of California was out with a study last week that, you know, that reported that the percentage of high school graduates going on to 4-year colleges in California has declined quite sharply. That's a result of the cuts we've made in higher education, the increases in tuition and fees at the higher education institutions, and that is, you know, devastating for California's future to see that trend continue. But that's where we are.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Paul, who was Deputy Treasurer of the State of California, and he's co-author with Joe Matthews of California Crack Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. So it seems to me that the villain in the piece here is Howard Jarvis. It's the idea, I mean, not that there wasn't some public outcry against property taxes, but Prop 13, which brought in these supermajority requirements that have hamstrung the state and prevented any realistic raising of any revenues. Meanwhile, you know, the benefits of Prop 13 have largely gone to industrial real estate and big apartment building owners and not necessarily the people that were supposedly going to be helping in the first place. And that has dried up the revenue sources for the schools. And California was dramatically changed by Prop 13. And he's a hero to some people. But, I mean, this seems like social Darwinism. I don't know why people think of him as a hero.
Well, certainly the two-thirds vote requirement has been a major impediment, as you described. It creates a system of minority rule in the legislature with regard to most everything having to do with money. The cuts, actually, though, the tax cuts that have hurt, you know, now have actually been enacted more recently. I mean, the elimination, or the deep cut in the vehicle license fee, the card, so-called car tax. In 97, there was a cut in income taxes. We've cut the corporate income tax rate and changed it in various ways that have reduced revenue. And we've seen this kind of across-the-board tax cutting that from in the late 90s, and we've never really come to terms with the fact that we've cut the tax base. One estimate is that if the taxes were at the same levels as 1997 in terms of tax rates, the California would have about $13 billion more revenue this year, more than enough to close the budget hole.
So this has all happened in the last few decades, because I was trying to make the point that prior to Prop 13, California had one of the leading education systems in the world, and now it's down there with Mississippi. And so as the Golden State's storied education system deteriorated, the prison industrial complex rose. And it just seems to me that that's a tragic story in itself.
Well, it's certainly, you know, California's decline in its willingness to invest in education and infrastructure, transportation, and the like, are going to have even longer term consequences for the state. The research shows that in the 21st century that the quality of the education of the population and the quality of infrastructure are the two most important determinants of economic success. So we have in California cut back on that investment, and we're going to, I think, pay a big price for that if we don't reverse course.
So just in closing, Mark Paul, why can't the governor make the points that you've made, that if we were just back to what we were in 1997, we'd be able to balance the budget? So all of these giveaways to corporations in the last decade ought to be reversed.
Well, he's gone at least part of the way with his proposal for the November ballot to temporarily raise rates, particularly on high-income earners. So we're going to have part of that discussion in California this year. It's, you know, he bit off a small piece of the problem. I think, you know, in Sacramento, the wisdom is entirely driven by polling, and I think what he chose to do was entirely, you know, driven by what they felt like voters could accept. But it's the best, you know, that we can hope that this year is with the Brown's tax initiative that we'll at least be able to stabilize the budget situation, albeit at this very low level of services for Californians.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Paul.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Paul, who's the co-author with Joe Matthews of California Crack Up, How Reform Broke the Golden State and How It Can Be Fixed. He was formerly national editor and editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune and deputy editorial page editor and columnist at the Sacramento Bee. In 2004, Mark Paul was appointed deputy treasurer of the state of California. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the sacrosanct military budget. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Stephen Carla, political psychologist, who is the director of the Program for Public Consultation and a senior research scholar at the Center for International Security Studies at Maryland University in Maryland. For the last 18 years, he's conducted in-depth studies of public opinion on public policy issues and has worked extensively with U.S. congressional staffers, State Department officials, and officials at the United Nations to develop surveys that help policymakers gain greater insight into the public values and beliefs. he has consulted with or testified to the United States Congress, NATO, and the European Commission. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Cull.
Thanks for having me.
And the latest study that you've done consulting the American people on national defense spending, you found that three-quarters of the respondents favor cutting defense in a way to reduce the deficit, including two-thirds of Republicans as well as 9 out of 10 Democrats. That flies in the face of what's happening with the U.S. House of Representatives, where the Republican majority is refusing to make any cuts in the defense budget, even though they signed a sequestered deal to do so.
Yeah, there is opposition to that action, though actually the law in place right now would call for some kind of a cut of about 10% unless a collective decision is made to the contrary.
But at this point, they're not going along with the 10% cuts.
Well, they're opposing them, yes.
Yes.
But the law in place right now says that this would occur unless there is an action against it.
Right, but my understanding is the action against it is that they're trying to come up with a substitute bill that would cut money from things like food stamps and leave defense untouched.
That's correct.
So this study of yours then indicates that there is a disconnect between the House of Representatives and the American people.
Yes, I think you would have to say that there's a real discrepancy between what is going on in the House and public opinion generally, and even among the Republicans in this country. We need to make clear that most Americans are not eager to cut defense. And if you just ask them straight up, do you want to cut defense, you don't have a majority saying, yes, let's do that. What was unique about this study was that we gave them information about how much spending goes to defense as compared to other items in the discretionary budget, how much we're spending now as compared to the past, how much we spend compared to Social Security and Medicare, how much we spend relative to enemies and allies. And on the whole, they were pretty surprised. It was more than they had expected. So when they got that information, when they had a more complete picture, and were also presented arguments for and against cutting, very strongly stated arguments that have been approved by advocates on both sides of the question, then when they really had a chance to think about it, large majority said, yes, let's make some substantial cuts.
So in other words, some of the basic information that's out there, for example, that the U.S. spends more on defense than I think just almost everybody in the world combined, certainly considerably more than the combined possible enemies, and we're spending more than today than we spent in the Cold War when we had a real enemy in the Russians who could wipe us off the map, as opposed to a few people living in caves. I mean, I'm astounded that this basic information is not out there.
Well, that's correct. People, when we showed people this information, we said, was this more than you expected, less than you expected, about the same as you expected? And in most cases, a majority said this was more than they expected. So they were clearly surprised. And yes, that information is not clearly out there. And there are a lot of statements that are made that confuse people. For example, there are times where the defense budget is going up, and there's a projected increase, there's a budgeted increase, and then there's an action to slow down or reduce the increase, and that is reported as a cut, when in fact it's a cut relative to a bigger increase. It's just not as big as was originally planned. And that gives people the impression that it's going up and down, when in fact it's been steadily going upward.
So over the years, my understanding is that one of the ways that the Department of Defense has kept its budget down is by offsetting a lot of it in other departments. For example, nuclear weapons are in the Department of Energy, the Coast Guard's in the Department of Transportation, etc. So even the figures that you're giving the respondents to your survey, which apparently are a learning experience for them, you could argue that they're not actually the full figures in any case.
Well, there are all these different ways to put together the defense budget. They're not grossly different, but they are different on the margins. And the number we gave them was for what's called the national defense budget, which does include the spending on nuclear weapons and the Department of Energy and so on. So it is the more comprehensive number, but we're talking only about a few percentage points variance here.
But what was interesting about your survey, Stephen Cull, consulting the American people on national defense spending, was that the area that the greatest percentage of people wanted to cut was nuclear weapons.
Yes, we did take people through the different areas of the budget, not just the overarching number, and we told them what really was going on in each area, like air power and ground forces, naval forces, as well as nuclear weapons and some others. And then we gave them arguments for and against cutting in those areas as well. And nuclear weapons was the one that was cut the most in terms of percentage. It was cut on average 27%.
And that's 18% by Republicans and 35% by Democrats.
It was bipartisan.
Sure. What other areas did, for example, 60 Minutes did a piece on the F-22 Raptor, a plane that cost close to $500 million a copy, and then a couple of the pilots went on camera and took tremendous risk with their careers, saying they're not going to fly until they fix the problems with the oxygen and some kind of toxic fumes that are affecting the pilots. Is any indication that kind of I know 60 Minutes is a pretty popular show. I'm wondering whether when you talk about when you broke this down and talked about some of the Air Force air power systems, did that ever come up, the F-22 Raptor?
Not that one specifically, but we did ask about the F-35, and 54% opposed, or 54% favored canceling that program, and 52% favored canceling the development of a next-generation bomber.
So there's a general understanding in the public that the U.S. is considerably ahead of anybody and everybody on the planet in terms of...
That argument was presented to them, and large majorities found it convincing. So that it appears that does resonate with them.
Again,
overall air power was existing air power is reduced on average 17%, and the development of new air capabilities was reduced on average 19%.
And how did they relate to manpower issues? In other words, are they more in favor of taking care of the men and women in uniform than the defense contractors?
Well, there was some support for raising the some co-pays for the families of military personnel, but there was opposition to increasing premiums or raising caps on payments for military retirees. There was some support for making modest changes in the pension system and slowing down the rate of growth of tax-exempt allowances, but there was resistance to increasing caps on wages and things like that for military personnel. So it was kind of a mixed bag, some things that they favored, some things they didn't. They were certainly not looking for real deep cuts there.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Cull, who is the director of the Program for Public Consultation and a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies. And he is the lead author of a study just released, Consulting the American People on National Defense Spending. The Afghanistan question is an interesting one, given the diminished public support for the war in Afghanistan. I believe it's down to, about two-thirds of the country are opposed to the Afghan war and sort of want to get out yesterday. Tell me about what you've learned about the budget figures for Afghanistan.
Well, just to clarify the general poll numbers, about two-thirds are unhappy about the war, questioning whether it was a good idea, that kind of thing. But you only have a modest majority who say, we want to really just get out. But it's still, and only recently, has become a slight majority. Now, when we asked about spending there, on average, people wanted to cut the spending that is now proposed for 2013 by an additional 40%, or $35 billion. So that, and just in, that was actually the biggest percentage cut in any area.
So from $88 billion for 2013 war spending in Afghanistan down to $35
billion. No, it was cut $35 billion down to, I think, 53 or so.
Well, that's pretty substantial.
And, yes, that is a sharp cut.
And that surely has got to worry the Obama administration. I mean, you clarified the notion that two-thirds of the public are uncomfortable or unhappy with the war, where only a slight majority want us to get out.
An additional number would like to reduce the number of troops that we have there. Mm-hmm. And so that all kind of rolls into reducing the amount of money that we're spending there.
Well, and how did you present that in terms of what the president just announced recently, that they're going to pretty much pull most of the troops out by 2014 and leave, 25,000 behind or something?
Yeah, we didn't focus so much on that side of it. We did present the arguments for and against reducing our presence there, or speeding up the reduction of our presence there, some saying that it's not really doing much good. Others saying that it's very important to prevent the Taliban from returning because this could create a safe haven for Al Qaeda. So they heard both arguments, but in the end they quite clearly came down on the side of reducing the spending there. Which, of course, means reducing the number of troops there.
So when you say both arguments are made, do you have people making these arguments, or do you have these are written arguments?
These are written. This is done online, so people can take all the time they want to read the argument, and then they evaluate how convincing they think it is. Now, I want to clarify, though, that this the sample is not just limited to people who have internet access. This is a fully randomly selected sample, scientifically selected in all the standard ways. And people are recruited by telephone and by mail to be part of this panel that's run by a group called Knowledge Networks. And then if people don't have internet access, they're given internet access. So we have a fully representative sample. And then the survey is administered over the internet. And what's generally been found, you get the best quality responses that way because people can take all the time they want to really reread and think it through.
And again, the main findings are that three-quarters of the respondents favored cutting defense as a way to reduce the deficit, including two-thirds of Republicans as well as nine out of 10 Democrats.
And on average, they reduced it 18%. With the Republicans reducing 12% and Democrats 22%.
And is this study, given that the Congress or the Republican House is pretty much adamantly refusing to budge on the defense budget at all, what is the likelihood of your study reaching them?
Well, I think it will get around. It's getting a fair amount of press coverage, and I've seen on television reporters asking members of Congress about it, so it's going to get some attention. Now, public opinion has limited influence on Congress, but I would say particularly these days when partisan agendas are so strong that the public has less influence. But it will enter into the picture to some extent, And it's true that the policymakers may just not have known what the public thinks. Because, as I said before, there are some polls out there. If you just ask people, do you want to increase, decrease, or maintain the current level of defense spending, you don't have a majority that immediately say, I want to decrease. But when they get more information and see the whole picture, and they see how much goes to defense as compared to other items in the budget and so on, then a large majority say, oh, yeah, well, that's where we really need to make cuts to deal with the deficit.
And in terms of your survey, you refer to defense spending, not military spending, and semantics are important. And I take it that the assumption would be, had you framed it as military spending, the people may want to even cut it further?
Perhaps. Those kinds of wording effects can be very strong when you just have one short question. But when you have a lot of information and people really get to think it through, it tends to then be somewhat less reactive to those little subtleties of wording.
Sure. Well, just in closing, Stephen Cull, tell me, you're a political psychologist. Tell me about what being a political psychologist involves.
Well, what we study is the psychology of how people react to political issues, how people think about political issues, feel about political issues, what they understand. It's easy to think of people as just being aligned with this party or that party or having a very fixed point of view. But what we found, for example, in doing this study is that people are complex. They can hear both sides of an issue. They don't say, well, I agree with this and I don't agree with that and that's it. But they have a kind of inner Congress in their mind, where they agree with to some extent with both sides. Now, what's striking is that in the end, they came down firmly on one side more than the other. But what was clear, though, is that they were actually listening carefully to and recognizing the validity of arguments on both sides. And again, that's the kind of thing you don't see happening in Congress. And that's one of the reasons that people are so frustrated with Congress. They think that Congress behaves in a way that just isn't really consistent with the way normal people act. And if you were to map the public out on a and Congress out on a sort of left-right spectrum, you would have a kind of, in Congress, you have a cluster on the left and a cluster on the right and very little in the middle. The public is just the opposite. They're a kind of normal curve around the middle. They cluster around the middle. And thus they're able to see both sides. And it creates a kind of, some confusion to some extent because they're hearing both sides in their mind, but still, in the end, they're able to make decisions, hard decisions that are much more, much harder than the kinds of decisions that Congress makes.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Stephen Cull.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Cull as a political psychologist. He's the director of the Program for Public Consultation and a senior research scholar at the Center for International and Security Studies at the University of Maryland. And he's been, for the past 18 years, conducting these in-depth studies of public opinion on policy issues and has worked extensively with the U.S. Congressional staff, State Department officials, the United Nations, and has consulted with the U.S. Congress, NATO, and the European Commission. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with a veteran financial reporter about the latest excess on Wall Street.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Impatient after impatient, this means war. Don't change a thing. Your mild billionaire mayor's now convinced he's a king. And so the boring collect I mean all disrespect. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. His other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble, and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the New York City Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Loom as the Next Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Lowenstein.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
And clearly, your account of what happened on Wall Street in 2008, it doesn't look like the players have changed their bad habits, given what just happened with J.P. Morgan Chase. And it was extraordinary to see that how much we'd seen that movie before, where a division in London is off the reservation making risky bets, and that and then it cascades back to Wall Street. I recall that happened with AIG, and there's a pattern here, surely.
Well, the instrument certainly was the same, the credit default swap that AIG used, but obviously the size is, you know, orders of magnitude less. J.P. Morgan Chase is in no, you know, trouble financially. It's going to remain even profitable in this quarter. I think what we're dealing with now isn't so much the main body of the book that we, you know, that we saw unfold in 2008, but this protracted epilogue in which we're trying to figure out what controls do we need to prevent the sorts of things that happened in 2008 from happening again, and how do we write them? Because, you know, as we've heard ad infinitum, the financial system is complicated. We want banks to be making loans. We want them you know, to be strong financially, but we want them to be taking risks, right? But on the other hand, we don't want, you know, in this case, one of the most respected banks there is thinking it was reducing its risk and going out and losing, you know, upwards of two, maybe $3 billion. So this tells us that, and this is occurring just as they're trying to put the finishing touches on two sets of rules that are meant to corral this, one being the Volcker rule against trading and the other an across-the-board set of rules about derivatives. So I think this certainly tells us that the follow-through from the crisis, the regulatory work, is a lot remains to be done.
So the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the one, which started, of course, on Wall Street in Zuccotti Park, that's clearly affected the debate, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think this is really going to be a very interesting issue in 2012 between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama because, well, with the added, Philip, that Mitt Romney comes from private equity. So, you know, I think they're going to offer very contrasting visions. You know, Mitt's going to say, I've spent my life, or before he became governor, his private enterprise life, looking for good companies to buy, trying to make them more efficient. You know, he's going to point to successes like Staples. He's going to say there were some failures, but that's what you get in capitalism. That's the system, and this is what you want, having bright people, find companies that can be improved, taken back public, and, you know, set on their way. And Obama is going to say that, you know, these things rely on a tremendous amount of debt, that there's, you know, more often than improving the companies, that there's financial engineering, creating profits for the bankers in the middle, but lost jobs and not any real efficiencies, and also lost taxes because of the great debt taken on, but not any real improvements. And you know, I think those, and that therefore we need more rules in the game. And I think those two contrasting visions, if they sort of each have the courage of their convictions to let that argument play out, you know, could offer us a very profound difference in November.
Well, there appears to be an overriding question here about the future of American capitalism, and in what you just said, my understanding is that as our economy becomes more and more financialized and Wall Street takes up a bigger and bigger chunk of the economy, we're in danger of the extraction model, the extraction concentration model, extracting wealth and concentrating at the top, not just being the norm, but being the future. And, you know, maybe there's no way that America can go back to a manufacturing economy, but the contrast is pretty stark between extracting wealth and creating wealth. And the rubber barons of old, for all of their failings, created wealth. They created jobs.
Right.
They created products. What do these guys do? That's a question a lot of lay people in this country have, is what do? They seem to shuffle paper money around and make money off that.
Well, in the case of private equity, it's particularly outrageous because a large share of their profits are taxed at only 15% rather than the top 35% now, and going to 39% that everybody else, you know, that a corporate executive, even a bank executive, someone in a doctor, a lawyer, whatever industry would pay, and why financial engineering is privileged to pay a low rate is really one of the outrages. But the question of how to fix inequality isn't so easy, because we seem to have a system where, say, top lawyers make a lot more than the other lawyers in their firm, and the top athletes, the Michael Jordans and so on of the world, make a lot more than everybody else. And so would, limiting how much they earn, would that help other people? Would that recreate solid middle-class factory jobs that used to exist? It's obvious that since we live in a global economy and we're, those factory workers are competing against factories in, all around the world, that alone is not going to do it. And so it's a lot easier to be unhappy about the level of inequality than to figure out, and it's a lot easier to find ways to chop the top down to size, namely tax them, than it is to figure out, well, how can we get the bottom and the middle to start rising? And that's, that is really the question that has plagued economic planners and thinkers since, the 1980s. And if either candidate could come up with an answer to that one, they'd really be onto something.
Well, I'm certainly not naive enough to expect and demand social good from Wall Street, but I think the argument is a question of how much social ill, how much predatory activities hurt Americans and hurt American consumers. And a stark example of that is how much the price of oil has been gamed and run up. And
I think I agree with you. I think there's too much trading, and I think there is a social good that finance in Wall Street plays, and that social good is raising money for industry, for new companies, for Silicon Valley, for, there's some new manufacturing companies now in the Midwest sprouting up again, and the role of Wall Street is to aggregate the savings of lots of, small and medium-sized savers throughout the country in stocks and bonds and pool them so industry can create jobs and so on. But if you look at a Goldman Sachs, which was, the Cadillac, the gold standard of raising money, of being an investment bank, that function is now something like 18% of its business, and basically all the rest is trading and trading type functions. And trading is basically a zero sum game where it's a casino type activities where somebody wins, somebody loses, but there's no net addition of capital into the economy. And unfortunately, for the Goldmans of the world, that type of activity has become more lucrative than the social good activity, which is raising capital.
Well, it's gotten to a point of almost surreal that they're moving their computers closer and closer to the stock exchange in order to get that millisecond advantage.
Yeah, I can't see this is super trading that I can't see any reason, frankly, to allow computers to trade, these computers that try to exploit so-called inefficiencies that appear and disappear within a fraction of a second. I mean, it just takes me back to the character Hal, who, of course, was a computer in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And the whole area of credit default swaps, which are basically an unregulated way of buying and selling insurance, which are really just, a huge gambling casino. I think of the most notorious example of trading activity with no social good, and this is what you referred to at the top of the interview, the real potential for harm, as we saw, of course, with AIG in 2008, and in a small way with J.P. Morgan this week.
So again, I'm speaking with Roger Lowenstein, the author of The End of Wall Street, which is out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. So in terms of what just happened with J.P. Morgan Chase, the loss of $2 billion, perhaps $3 billion, out of a small unit in London, a French trader whose nickname was the London Whale, apparently made these trades. His boss, she was recently fired. But to get a handle on what he was up to, Roger Lowenstein, he was trading in derivatives and trying to hedge, but was obviously taking risks at the same time. And it brings up this question of the Volcker Rule and whether there is a way that you can put a regulatory wall between hedging and taking reckless risks.
You know, if I've been reading the accounts correctly, I think there might be. It's J.P. Morgan, like other banks, had a lot of exposure to Europe. And at some point, I believe last summer, they got worried about this, meaning they had loans out to companies and probably to countries, too, in Europe, and they wanted to hedge it. So they basically bought, very large insurance policies, just like you and I would buy one, say, if our house burns down, would be paid off. In this case, they bought insurance against there being a calamity in Europe, and they did it via the derivatives market. And as far as I understand, the Volcker Rule would allow that because you're trying to reduce the risk on your portfolio. It's called portfolio hedging. At some point then, between last summer and now, and this is where they got into trouble and I think skirted what the Volcker Rule would allow. Of course, hasn't been implemented yet, so they weren't violating the rule. But they said, Europe doesn't look so bad. We don't really need all this protection. And they made bets the other way. What they were doing then was selling insurance to other people who still wanted protection against Europe. Now they were in the position of the insurance seller, not the insurance buyer. And I think they bought too much of this. They more than balanced out their previous position. Recently, Europe has again come a cropper with the turmoil in the French and Greek elections and the trouble in Spain, and they took a huge hit. So one could argue that in a post-Volcker Rule world, they'd be allowed to do step one, but not step two, and they wouldn't have had this loss. Now, whether they would have stopped after step one and before step two, because it does seem as though they themselves were unaware of the risk they were running, we'll have to see. This stuff is complicated, and it does make me nervous.
Well, it's complicated, but on the other hand, I've been covering Europe for some time now, and it's been pretty obvious that the ECB has not gotten their hands around this crisis, that it's gone on longer and longer, and the more it goes on, the worse it gets. It's just extraordinary to think that somebody could have bet in the opposite direction, particularly at a time when Greece was unraveling, and as you mentioned, Spain is going through a banking crisis as well. But it gets to the question, Roger Lowenstein, I don't know whether this is an accurate figure, but this is the one that's being bandied about, is that there are $700 trillion in derivatives looming out there.
Well, the figure is accurate, but you have to know what the figure is accurate, what it says. People frequently phrase a derivative bet this way. They'll say, I will pay you if the price of wheat goes up, you'll pay me if it goes down, and we'll say, let's make this about, the amount will be how the movement, the total movement, will say in $1 billion worth of wheat. So then that'll count as $1 billion worth of derivatives. Now, if the price of wheat moves, say, 1%, you or I would lose or gain $10 million, not $1 billion. But that we're betting over the movement in $1 billion, and they're derivative bets, to use your figure, over the movement of $700 trillion. Now, no one's going to lose $700 trillion. It's going to be a fraction of that, and many of those bets, they'll cancel each other out. People will be on one side of one and then the other side of a similar bet. So it's, All you can say for certain is, 10 years ago there were a few trillion. So the size of derivatives has just exploded, and they cry out for more regulation and supervision. And this brings me back to the Dodd-Frank call on the regulators to write some tough rules, and unfortunately these rules have been in the regulatory process really whittled down as Wall Street has lobbied Washington.
Well, there's no question that the banking lobby is perhaps one of the most powerful in Washington, and the fact that they've been successfully whittling it down is a measure of their influence. But some time ago, Warren Buffett referred to derivatives as financial weapons of mass destruction. He's often considered fairly prophetic. He certainly has a pretty good track record in terms of making money for his shareholders. What do you make of that statement?
I think he's right. Notwithstanding, Warren Buffett has played in with some weapons of mass destruction himself, but so far he hasn't gotten burned on them. I think when you do something, in particular, credit default swaps. There are lots of types of derivatives. If you buy a corn futures contract, that's a derivative. There are all sorts of derivatives. But if you sell a credit default swap, which literally means you're giving someone else the right to stick you with whatever the loss is in a default, in a credit default, you're really assuming insurance risk, and you're doing it without a state insurance commissioner looking to see if you've evaluated the risk, if your capital is sufficient, all the things that have basically protected the traditional insurance industry, for generations. And I think, in particular, credit default swaps are weapons of mass financial destruction.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Roger Lowenstein.
It was a real pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Lowenstein, who's the author of The End of Wall Street, which is out in paperback. Roger Lowenstein is a financial journalist who wrote for The Wall Street Journal for more than a decade and continues to write for The New York Times, Smart Money, and other publications. His other books include When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, Origins of the Crash, The Great Bubble and Its Undoing, While America Aged, How Pension Debts Ruined General Motors, Stopped the NYC Subways, Bankrupted San Diego, and Looms as the Next Financial Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.